This is a CBC podcast.
Hey, I'm Craig Norris, and I want to invite you to check out the R330. It's kind of like Quirks and Quarks, except I don't talk about space or science or anything like that. Instead, I play the week's best Canadian indie music. Head over to cbcradio3.com for all of the info.
From Centennial Hall in London, Ontario, it's the Vinyl Cafe with Stuart McLean. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks for joining us, everyone. This is our annual Christmas concert. It's maybe my favorite show of the year. Christmas at the Vinyl Cafe is becoming a tradition for me. So I was delighted to learn just the other day that the very first radio show ever, the very first use of radio waves to broadcast entertainment was on Christmas Eve 101 years ago this week. Everyone, thanks. Everyone thinks Marconi invented the radio. Everyone has heard about that night, which was also a December night when Marconi allegedly, there are skeptics, Marconi allegedly transmitted Morse code signals from his transmitter in Cornwall, England, to Signal Hill in St. John's, Newfoundland. Dots and dashes that may or may not have been discernible over the noise of the night. Whether he did or didn't may be debatable, but if he did, you can call it whatever you want, an amazing scientific leap, yes, but not a radio show. It wasn't a radio show. Turns out the father of radio wasn't Marconi at all, but an unheralded Canadian, Reginald Aubrey Fessenden. You can look it up. You can read all this on the web. Born in East Bolton, Quebec, educated at Trinity College in Port Hope and Bishop's School in Lennoxville, he was an inventor. Fessenden held patents on things like electrical tape and microfilm. He built the first power-generating plant at Niagara Falls, but his dream was to send voices through the air without cables or wires. And he was the first to do that. He broadcast a voice 50 feet in 1900. And he was in a race with Marconi. And to prove that he was ahead, on that Christmas Eve in 1906, Fessenden sent a message to wireless operators working on ships that belonged to the United Fruit Company, ships sailing off the Atlantic coast. He told them to listen to their receivers at 9 o'clock that night for something special. And you can just imagine them in the cold darkness of a December night, with the North Atlantic winds blowing off the crests of the waves. You can imagine them huddled around their little receivers, which had only picked up beeps and buzzes before that. And what must have gone through their minds, what they must have thought when they heard music. It would have been like a dream, miracle. Fessenden began his broadcast by playing a recording of Handel's Largo on his Ediphone. His wife and secretary were supposed to read from the Bible next. They were going to read an account of the birth of Christ from the book of Luke. But they were seized by a spasm of stage fright. So Fessenden went to the microphone in their place. And he extended Christmas greetings to his listeners. And then he did what radio hosts are wont to do. He asked them to write in and tell them how they liked the show. And I thought with us gathered together today, both at home and here, and this being our Christmas show, we shouldn't let the moment pass without tipping our hats to the long-ignored Mr. Fessenden. He was, incidentally, an amateur musician. Fessenden played the violin. And the other thing he did over the radio during that first radio show ever 101 years ago this week was to play his violin. And while he played, he sang. And the song he chose was O Holy Night. Ladies and gentlemen, Would you please welcome to the Vinyl Cafe from Montreal, Quebec, Alison Russell. That was Alison Russell. So speaking about radio, as I was a moment ago, one of my favorite moments on this radio show every year is the day we hand out the Vinyl Cafe Arthur Awards. The Arthurs are named after Dave's dog. Like all good dogs, they're modest and unassuming by nature. These are the awards we hand out to recognize the importance of the unimportant, to celebrate small acts that too often go unnoticed. So this year we gave one of our Arthur Awards to a young man from Riverview, New Brunswick. Jamie Hawkins, by his own admission, barely scraped through high school. And after that, he wasn't going anywhere in a hurry. Jamie turned his life around, however, when he turned 27. He gave up drinking, got himself into St. Mary's University in Halifax, Nova Scotia, as a mature student. And since starting at St. Mary's, Jamie has maintained an A average. He's also racked up about $45,000 in student loans. So one day last year, Jamie went into the cafeteria at the St. Mary's Student Union before class, and he stopped at the bank machine to get some money. And there, right next to the ATM, he found a bundle of bills the size of a loaf of bread. $10,000 in cash, just sitting there. Well, Jamie picked up the money and he looked around and without hesitation, he took it to the student union office. Okay, maybe he hesitated. Turned out the money had been dropped by some security guards. Well, we gave him an Arthur for being his best self. When we presented it to him, I asked Jamie if his former self would have handed the money in, and he paused and said, "That's a good question." I tend to think not. Well, I felt pretty good about giving Jamie his Arthur. I thought, well, that was the problem, actually, because when I did stop and think about it, I realized it meant absolutely nothing. You don't get anything when you win an Arthur. You don't even get to choose a song on the show. And when I thought about that, I decided Jamie really deserved more. So over the last few months, whenever we've taken the Vinyl Cafe tour bus out, and we've traveled across much of this country over the past few months, whenever we've done a show, I mentioned Jamie's story and that we had a bucket with us. It was an empty paint can, actually. And we put it in every theater lobby, and I told people if they felt so inclined, they could throw a loony or toony in the bucket so we could gather up a reward for Jamie. I made it clear I didn't want anything big, just toonies or loonies. I believe that comings together are all the grander when they're the comings together of the many rather than the comings together of the few. I told myself we'd keep collecting until this year's Christmas concert, and that's today. So I thought I'd tell you how much we got. And I thought if I was going to tell you, I should tell Jamie too. And we have him on the line now from Halifax. Jamie, can you hear me?
Hi, Stuart. How you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Did you finish exams?
I'm all done.
How'd they go?
They went not bad.
The way you want all exams to go. So listen, a few months ago I told you we were going to give people a chance to contribute to a little reward for you.
Yes.
Well, we've been collecting coins at every show since Thanksgiving. So you want to know how much we got?
Oh, geez, that'd be great.
38 $10 bills, 41 $20 bills, handful of checks, and buckets of loonies and toonies, and it all adds up to $15,079.21.
Oh, God. Wow. That's amazing.
And it's all yours.
Holy. Oh, I'm speechless. That's fantastic. Thank you so much.
What are you going to do with it?
I'm probably going to put it right back on my student loan.
Which is... Which is how much now?
Close to $45,000.
So do you have anything else you want to say?
Just thank you so much, Stuart. Like, it's truly amazing that you facilitated this for me, and thanks all those people that donated. I just feel so great. Thank you.
Well, I think you did it. I think people would probably want to thank you. You did a good thing. You did the right thing. And I think when people do good things, they should be recognized for them. And obviously, I'm not the only one who thinks that. Most of the donations were loonies and toonies, which means, just as we hope, this was a coming together of the many, not of the few.
Yeah.
I think people wanted to thank you or recognize you for being your best self. Because when you did that, or when any of us manage that, we allow others to be their best selves too.
Exactly. Yeah. It's really changed my life. You know, it's just to see reaction from this. It's really taught me a valuable lesson and something that I hope I can only pass on in the future.
What lesson have you, what's it taught you?
Well, it's just taught me that my old me was very selfish, and the act that I did was very unselfish, and I know that that's very rewarding, so that's what I've learned from that.
Anything else you want to say?
Thank you very much, and have a Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Jamie. I'll see you.
All right. Take care, folks.
Bye-bye. We're going to get Alison Russell up again now.
Put your weight on me, honey. Drop it on me like a stone. I'll take all your heavy weather. It's light as a feather. I'll never leave you alone. Put your weight on me, honey. Drop it on me like a stone. Right now I feel like I'm never gonna let you down. Right now I feel like I'm never gonna let you down. The thing about these beautiful mornings that don't stay for long. But right now I feel like I'm never gonna let you down. So God bless this beautiful morning till it's gone. God bless this beautiful morning till it's gone. How I'm gonna feel when it goes, I don't know. That's another song. God bless this beautiful morning till it's gone. God this beautiful morning till it's gone. God bless this beautiful morning till it's gone. How I'm gonna feel when it goes, I don't know. That's another sound. God bless this beautiful morning till it's gone.
Alison Russell. Our next guest has released 6 solo albums over the last decade, yet the Toronto Star has called him Canada's undiscovered musical treasure. I happen to agree, and that's why he's here today. I want you to meet him. When we had him on the Vinyl Cafe concert we recorded at the Black Sheep Inn in Wakefield a couple of years ago, he knocked my socks off. Would you please welcome, from Kitchener-Waterloo, Danny Michel.
Follow footprints through the snow, right down the middle of the road, and the Christmas lights across the lake, and the Christmas cheer and the angel cake. Mistletoe, the candy cane, I ride your bumper down the lane. The panning steady cam, slow mo, zooms with a hypnotizing flow. Here in this snow globe, perfect night. You keep shaking, you keep shaking, you keep shaking, shaking, you keep shaking. Keep shaking, you 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 keep shaking keep shaking, shaking. You keep shaking my life. The sky is falling.
Danny Michel, and that's from his Best Of album, collection of the best songs of the last 10 years. It was the middle of December, and it still hadn't snowed. And that wasn't the half of it. It hadn't threatened snow. It hadn't even rained. It was the middle of December, and all the clouds on the horizon were, well, that was the problem. There were no clouds on the horizon. I know, said Dave, is this great or what? It's kind of weird, said Morley. When Morley was a little girl, winter had always announced itself by the end of November, that dark month of ravens, rain, and rings around the moon. You could feel it in your bones. One afternoon, you'd be out burning leaves, wool mittens, and a toque, and the clouds would gather, and the temperature would drop, and pretty soon, the whole sky would be gray. Feels like snow, your dad would say. Morley's dad used to start their rink in December. Standing in the backyard after supper, his mittens frozen to the hose, Morley used to watch through the kitchen window, wiping the steam with her sleeves. There were no rinks this December. Here it was, mid-December, Christmas coming. It hadn't snowed, and there wasn't a cloud on the horizon. Hope we get snow for Christmas, said Morley. She was in her PJs, standing by the bedroom window, looking out at the night street. Dave was sitting in bed, looking at her and thinking how beautiful she looked. Morley said, what are the words from that hymn, the one about the snow? Dave said, good King Wenceslas? Right, said Morley. Where's good King Wenceslas when we need him? They were lying in bed a few days later, reading. And Morley put her book on her lap, and she said, I really want it to snow. And Dave didn't even look up. It will, he said. Promise, said Morley. How about Christmas Eve? Could you arrange that? Done deal, said Dave. And then he looked at her earnestly, and he said, it'll snow, and it will be deep and crisp and even. And so the days closed in on Christmas. And the decorations went up, and all the old carols came on the radio, and cards came in the mail, but no snow came. They were all going through the motions, but no one was in the spirit of it. Except for Mary Turlington, of course. The weather didn't seem to bother Mary Turlington one little bit. Christmas was coming, and Mary, God bless her oblivious little heart, had been full steam ahead since June. Victorian Christmases are so passé, said Mary one afternoon in September. I'm working on an Elizabethan theme this year. Mary kept calling Morley over to show her things that she had picked up. A lute and a mandolin for the twins. An exquisite midnight blue crushed velvet floor-length dress with faux pearls for herself. And for Bert, well, she got Bert what every man wants to wear on Christmas morning. A leather jerkin. One Saturday night in early November, Dave ran into Bert near the park. Do you mind, said Bert. Dave and Bert don't have a lot in common, but they both walk around the neighborhood at night. Dave and his dog, Bert and his caseload. Be my guest, said Dave. They both enjoy these nocturnal collisions. Bert's a defense attorney. Dave, his surrogate judge and jury. But Bert wasn't thinking of legal arguments this night. She doesn't think I'm committed to Christmas, said Bert. Bert didn't look happy, not one bit. All I said was I wanted turkey and gravy for Christmas dinner. That's right, said Dave. Now, Dave knew he didn't have to say much here. Dave's role in these conversations is to play the part of a Southern Baptist congregation. It's not like we have turkey and gravy every week, said Bert. That's right, said Dave. If I was Elizabethan, said Bert, I wouldn't want turkey and gravy. Tell me, said Dave. But what I'd want, said Bert, is wild game. True dat, said Dave. Then Bert shook his head morosely. Bert said, she found a page of Elizabethan menus online. Bert said, she wants me to find her a swan. She wants to roast a swan. Dave said, amen. Christmas presents. Christmas shopping. A husband looking for the perfect presents like a knight from the round table on the quest for the Holy Grail. He can saddle up his trusty steed and head off gamely into the Christmas chaos. And he can set off with courage as his trusty companion. But as soon as he leaves the comforts of home, he'll find that his old pal Doubt has saddled up the mule of confusion and is clip-clopping along at his side. And before he even gets to the malls, that traitor conviction will have turned and fled, and deep in his anxious little knight heart, he will begin to wonder if the thing he's looking for really exists. Oh, he's heard the rumors. There was a man once who said he heard of a fellow who told a story about a guy who found the perfect present. But that's just a legend. One of those Christmas stories people tell to promote hope among the recklessly faithful. If you ever tracked him down, you'd find out the man who found the perfect present was just another poor sod alone in his bedroom on Christmas Eve, with a roll of wrapping paper, some scotch tape, and a waffle iron. But just like Arthur's knights, men head out every year. And just like last year and the year before, Dave picked up his sword and shield this December and headed out to join them. Dave looked at Bert Turlington and said, I promised Morley I'd make it snow. Bert said, who do you think you are, Al Gore? Dave shrugged. She said that's all she wanted. Bert says, does she have a waffle iron? You could get her a waffle iron. You can find just about anything on the internet. Bert ordered a side of duck bacon, 2 young grouse, 3 Irish brown hare, 4 boar hind shanks, 5 Scottish wood pigeons, 6 venison chops, and 2 pounds of ground kangaroo. Dave, downloaded plans for a snowmaking machine. Turns out if you want to make snow, all you need is a garden hose, an air compressor, and less than $100 worth of plumbing fittings. Dave assembled his machine at his record store in an afternoon, whistling while he worked. Good King Wenceslas. Dave was on the road to gift-giving perfection. Before you knew it, it was the day of Christmas Eve. And just as predicted, the temperature dropped. And just as predicted, there was no sign of snow anywhere. Mary Turlington showed up at Dave and Morley's early that afternoon. She looked exhausted. "I've been up since 4 a.m., said Mary. Mary was holding a platter covered in wax paper. "That's homemade wax paper," said Mary. On the platter, there were a dozen shimmering nuggets of gold, each one about the size of a golf ball. "Hazelnut truffled praline," said Mary. Then she said, "That's edible gold leaf." Mary had made the dessert from scratch. She had roasted the chocolate herself. She had toasted the hazelnuts. Mary had been up since dawn, before dawn, dipping the nuts into the silky chocolate. She'd used tweezers and a magnifying glass to cover each truffle with the edible gold leaf. "It's not," she said, pushing a strand of hair off her forehead. "It's not as easy as it looks." It didn't look easy. "They look fit for a queen," said Morley. "No queens work this hard," said Mary. Dave didn't begin making snow until the middle of the night. He waited until everyone was asleep, and then he slipped out of bed and snuck out of the bedroom. Arthur, asleep on top of the heat vent, cocked his head. When he saw Dave heading downstairs, Arthur stood up, shook, and followed. The lights on the Christmas tree were still on. Dave got dressed in their glow. He loved this. The secret quiet of Christmas Eve. All the little colored lights. All the boxes and bags spilling across the living room. It wasn't the presents that were important. It was the impulse behind them. The spirit they represented. The spirit of giving. Christmas gives you permission to say things out loud that you might otherwise not say. As Dave pulled on his socks, he felt a surge of emotion. It was like love, except bigger. And it extended beyond his house and family and included everyone. Dave shook his head. He was feeling love for people he had never met. People he'd probably hate if he got to know them. He went outside. Arthur stood by the back door and whined. When Dave didn't come back for him, Arthur went upstairs and climbed quietly onto the forbidden bed. He settled into Dave's place, his head on Dave's pillow. It was cold outside and dark. Dave pulled his chuck low and got to it. He wrestled his new air compressor out of the trunk of the car and pushed it down the driveway. He fetched the black garden hose from the basement. He got his snow gun from its hiding place in the garage. According to the instructions, making snow would be surprisingly easy. The air pressure would convert the water into misty droplets, and as the mist sprayed across his property, it would freeze in the chilly night. And if all worked as it was supposed to, that is, if the air was just the right temperature and the droplets were just the right size, they would freeze and fall onto the ground like snow. Dave stood by the back porch, his breath coming in smoky puffs. He opened the faucet. He ran back to the compressor and flicked it on. It was louder than he'd imagined. It sounded like a train. Upstairs, Arthur lifted his head. Morally stirred restlessly, she reached out in her sleep for her husband. Her arm landed on the dog instead. Arthur sighed and cuddled beside her. Morley sighed and drifted back to sleep. Outside, Dave was holding his snow wand in front of him, and wonder of wonders, the mist that was hissing from the nozzle was arcing into the sky and floating onto his driveway. His driveway was turning white. Dave was making snow. Upstairs at the Turlingtons, Mary was trying to wake her husband.
Bert! It sounds like a gas leak.
Mary turned on her bedside lamp. Bert rolled over and sighed. It did sound like a gas leak. Bert got up and walked toward the bedroom window. He was reaching for the curtain.
Bert! Don't make sparks.
Bert jerked his hands back and rubbed them against his pajamas. And then he pulled the curtain back. A shaft of light spilled across the driveway. Dave looked up and saw Bert's silhouette. He smiled, turned, and he blasted the window with a snow wand. Whoa, said Bert, jumping back with surprise. It's really snowing. It's a blizzard, said Bert, peering out the window. It's one of those freak storms. If this keeps up, the city will be buried by morning. Then Bert padded back to bed.
Bert, said Mary, what's the sound?
It's the wind, said Bert. It's wicked out there. I couldn't even see the driveway.
It sounds like a train, Bert.
Bert was already falling back to sleep. Bert said, that's what they always say about hurricanes. After he blasted Bert, Dave danced down his driveway, holding the snow wand over his head. He was pretending to be Gene Kelly and singing in the rain. He was turning the world white. He had kept his promise. 3 hours later, Dave had stopped dancing. 3 hours later, he was standing in the driveway as cold as a February gravestone. His feet were numb, his fingers wet. He was chattering and dithery. He took a glove off and blew on his fingers. He was going to freeze to death out there. He fetched a stepladder from the garage and he tied his snow wand to the very top rung. The higher it was, the further the spray had to travel before it hit the ground. The further it traveled, the more time it had to freeze. He propped the ladder against the Turlington's porch. He pointed the nozzle towards his property, and then he went inside. It was 8 a.m. when Morley woke up. She reached out to Dave and said, Merry Christmas. Dave opened one weary eye. He was surprised to find himself in bed. Merry Christmas, he said, unsure, trying to assemble what had happened through the fog of his sleep. And then he remembered it all, and he sat up. He had finally got the perfect present. He had finally hit the ball clear out of the park. For once, Christmas was about to go off without a hitch. Dave said, why don't you go and check? Why don't you go see if it snowed? Morley looked out the window. The entire neighborhood was green, except for her yard. Morley's yard was a winter wonderland. There was snow everywhere. Dave, she said. And Dave, who was still sitting in bed, said it again. Merry Christmas, said Dave. I love you. They woke the kids and they ran outside. His snow machine had toppled over on its back, but it was still running. The snow was a little slushy, but there was so much of it, there was a big drift between their house and the Turlingtons. They opened their presents. Then they went outside again and they played in Morley's snow. Sam started to make a snowman. Dave hurled a snowball at him, and they had a snowball fight. And so the day went by. It was Sam who eventually climbed to the top of the snowdrift. It was getting dark when Sam climbed up and looked and pointed. "Hey," he said, "look." He was pointing at the Turlington's house. The Turlington's house had been hidden by the drift. There wasn't a window or door that hadn't been frozen shut. The Turlingtons had been trapped in there since dawn. Bert had sat everybody down and told them not to worry. "It's like this all over the city," he said. Dave climbed to the top of the drift. The first thing Dave saw was the Turlington's ice-encrusted power lines lying in the backyard. What he couldn't see was Mary Turlington. Behind the ice-covered windows in her floor-length Elizabethan gown and large white powdered wig, determined Mary, never say die Mary, was kneeling in front of the living room fireplace trying to cook Christmas dinner. She was holding a stick over the flames, roasting a frozen pigeon like a marshmallow. It took Dave and Morley nearly an hour to chip their way through the ice that had sealed up the Turlington's front door. Bert and the kids standing on the other side cheering them on the whole time. Bert told the kids it was the Red Cross coming to rescue them. So when the door opened and Dave and Morley were standing there on their stoop and they saw their green front lawn and the green neighborhood, there was a moment of confused silence. Mary was back at the fire. Mary had just removed a scorched and ash-covered carcass from the flames. When she saw Morley, Mary wiped her greasy hands on her wig, struggled up, and muttered, "Those Elizabethans were nuts." It was Morley who invited the Turlingtons for supper. "Well," sighed Mary, who had just experienced a more authentic Elizabethan Christmas than she had counted on, "I still have my chocolate dessert. I could bring my dessert." And so the Turlingtons, in all their greasy, soot-stained splendor, came for Christmas dinner. And as tends to happen when neighbors drop in and there are a few too many people for the family table, dinner took on an unexpected festive turn. Bert sat on a piano bench at one end of the table, reveling in his plate of turkey and potato. "Gravy?" said Bert joyfully when Morley offered. "I love gravy." Even poor Mary, whose big white wig seemed oddly appropriate at the table where everyone else was wearing paper crowns, even poor Mary seemed to be enjoying herself. When they cleared the turkey from the table, Mary said, "Where are the chocolates? I'll get them." And Dave said, "No, no, you sit. Let me do it." And Dave disappeared into the kitchen to fetch Mary's homemade chocolate dessert. And while he was gone, Mary explained to the kids about the cocoa beans from Venezuela and about chocolate ganache and edible gold leaf. "Each one is worth a fortune," said Mary. And Sam said, "I get to eat real gold? What's taking so long?" And Morley said, "Dave?" And Dave called, "Just a minute," from the kitchen. "I'm just about finished." And Mary said, "What's he doing in there?" And that's when Mary stood up. And that's when everything started to move in slow motion. When Mary stood up, when she stood up and walked into the kitchen, and Dave was sitting at the table, beaming at her like a kid who had just made his parents their first breakfast in bed. "Last one," said Dave. Dave was holding up one of her chocolates for inspection. All the gold leaf had been carefully peeled off. "Last one," he said. Then he said, these little gold wrappers sure are tricky. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, sadly, we've come to the part of the show where we have to say farewell. Before we do, I want to thank everybody who's been with me this afternoon. Chris Whiteley, Dennis Pendroth, John Sheard, Allison Russell, and Danny Michelle. Before we go, we have time to sing one last song. It's a song that I really like. It's one of my favorites, and you probably know the words. If you want to sing along or hum along or just think along, please join in. We're gonna get Allison to start it off for us. Here we go now. People I want to thank before we go. I want to thank Brad Scruton, Bill Herault, Ted Decker, Frank Finistori, and Ron Skinner for the technical assistance. Dave Amers, the founding producer of the Vinyl Cafe. Louise Curtis is the production assistant. Julie Penner is the music producer. Meg Masters is the long-suffering story editor. The Vinyl Cafe is produced by Jess Milton. I'm Stuart McLean, and this is your last chance to sing along. So long for now.
And the Vinyl Cafe are on tour right now. They're making stops this week in Toronto, London, Hamilton, Kitchener, Ottawa, and Ogdensburg, New York. In the new year, Stuart McLean will be bringing the show to the Maritimes. You can check the website for a complete list of tour dates, vinylcafe.com.
We'll see you next year. Go home to your families.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.